For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And welcome to the class from UC Divinity School. It's joining us here in Olympus Crescendo, and to everybody online. I'm Taigen Layton, the guiding teacher of Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. We are in the middle of a practice commitment period, focusing on the teachings of Pongzhe, mostly from this book, Cultivating the Empty Field. Pongzhe was in the early 1100s, most important teacher in the Saodong or Soto school in that period, and very important influence on Dogen a century later, who brought the school to this teaching to Japan, and whose teachings we study, and we're part of the Soto branch of Buddhism. Today I want to talk about Hongzhe's teaching to romp and play in samadhi. Samadhi is a technical term in Indian Buddhism, sometimes later, for particular concentrations, particular meditation practices. But in general, in East Asia, it's also just a general term for meditation and zazen that we do here. Hongzhe says to romp and play in samadhi. I'm going to read from the four places in the practice instructions where he talks about this. Sometimes I've translated it as roam and play in samadhi. It's the same character. But just to review, for the people in the practice period or not, some of the main themes we've been talking about from Hongzhe's teaching are returning to the source, finding the source of creation, of this reality right now, not a historical source, but just right now, what is the source of all of this. And one of the ways we do this is, as Hongzhe and Dogen refer to, taking a backward step, turning our attention inward, which we do when we sit facing a wall, and bring awareness to the whole situation of our body and mind as we face the wall and ourselves and the world. So that's one theme, this theme of the ultimate source. Another theme that Hongzhe emphasizes that we've talked about is the Buddha work, that there's some work for Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to do. So Bodhisattvas are, maybe you've already talked about this, but Bodhisattvas are practitioners dedicated to universal awakening. So this isn't just a self-help practice, but a way of bringing awareness to all beings. Another theme we talked about is the ancestors. So that has many aspects. The ancestors in the lineage from Shakyamuni Buddha 2,500 years ago in what's now northeastern India, down to Bodhidharma, who brought that from India to China and started what's called Chan or Zen, Chan in Chinese, and the lineage of many ancestors since then, up to Hongzhe, down to Dogen, down to Suzuki Roshi, who brought this teaching and practice to California in the 60s, and we're in his lineage. And then also responding, just response to suffering, to the world. This goes along with the Buddha work, but to respond to the situation around us, to the situation of our everyday life and activity. So those are some of the major themes of Hongzhe's teaching. And this romping and playing in samadhi includes all the other themes. And so it's not about, you know, when we sit upright in Zazen, as we've done here now, it's not about being stiff or somber, or even though it might look like being stoic, but Hongshu recommends, encourages us to enjoy our imagination and to romp and play in samadhi. So I want to read some examples of what he says about that. And we'll have time for discussion and questions after. So from the section of total trust, romp and play in samadhi, simply realize mutual response and explore mutual response, then turn around and enter the world, romp and play in samadhi. So this is the other side of turning within and facing the wall. Realize mutual response. So this idea of response and mutual response with each other and with the world is very important in this teaching. Then turn around and enter the world. Roam and play in samadhi. Every detail clearly appears before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow happen instantly without leaving traces. The outside and myself do not dominate each other, only because no perceiving of objects comes between us. So Hongshu also talks a lot about perception and not being caught by the objects of perception, colors and sounds, including thoughts as an object of perception. Only this non-perceiving, he continues, encloses the empty space of the Dharma realm's majestic 10,000 forms. So the Dharma realm is everything. Dharma means teaching, it means truth, it means all the so-called objects of our awareness. So the entire Dharma realm, informed by the teaching, he says that only this non-perceiving encloses the empty space of the Dharma realm's majestic 10,000 forms. People with the original faith should enact and fully investigate the field without neglecting single fragment. So he's talking about paying attention, but also with some feeling of play. This is very important in our practice. So I'll talk more about that. There's a feeling of playfulness, of romping even. Another place he talks about this is the section they call 10 billion illuminating spirits. Rely only on the source of creation, says. So the source of creation in Buddhism is not something that happened way back in Genesis or something like that. It's not historical or even chronological. It's the source that is arising right now. Dependent co-arising of all things right now. Where is the source of that? How do we see that arising? That's the practice about looking at the source. Rely only on the source of creation, Hongshu says. If you feel a shadow or the hair's gap, nothing will be received. Just experience and respond appropriately. So again, this sense of response. It's not kind of stoic dead sitting. We're paying attention. We're aware as we sit in silence and stillness. From this singular impact, many thousands of roads open, and all things are preeminent. All things are preeminent. Not to ignore anything. With this unification, I radiantly speak the Dharma. The self divides in 10 billion distinct illuminating spirits fully, without effort. So to be aware of the world without dividing it into objects and classifying and deliberating about the differences, but just to see the wholeness of it all. So he says, the self divides into 10 billion distinct illuminating spirits. Distinguish these without falling into names and classifications, and according fully, without effort. The mirror is clear and magnanimous. And we might see the wall as a mirror showing us ourselves. The valley is empty but echoes. From the beginning, unbound by seeing or hearing, the genuine self romps and plays in samadhi without obstruction. When enacted like this, how could it not be beneficial? So there's these two sides, we could say. There's this turning within. They're not separate, actually. They're not two separate things, but turning within to, as Dogen says, study the self, to be aware of thoughts and feelings, not to try and get rid of them or suppress them, but just to become intimate with ourselves, with our own mind, with thoughts and feelings, with habit patterns, without needing to be caught by them, without responding, but not relying on them, not reacting. So there's that, and then we come out from meditation or longer meditation retreats, like the one we'll do at the end of next month, and meet the world and respond openly. And how to respond is, there's not one right way. This is an extensive practice. How we each, from our own place, can be helpful in responding to the situations in our life and in the world. Another practice instruction. He says, arrive at this field, openly letting go of dependency. When conditioned dust do not pollute it, all situations are intimately matched. So dust is a technical term for sense objects. When all the sense objects of our conditioning in our particular body and mind in this particular world, when we're not caught by those, all situations are intimately matched. Like box and lid joining and arrow points meeting, these are auspicious and do not miss the mark. Romping and playing in samadhi, people in this state accept their function. This is another important teaching in the Soto school in Hongzhou and also very much in Dogen, accepting our function. Dogen talks about our dharma position. Finding and realizing and accepting and inhabiting the situation of our life, of our situation, of the situation of the people around us and the world around us. That which is on our mind this week, this month, this lifetime, to accept our function. And function implies this active point. It's not passive. It may look passive, just sitting, looking at the wall, but it's actually investigating with our body how it is that thoughts and feelings arise, how we get caught by them, becoming familiar with our habit patterns. And then how do we respond? So again, the importance of responding to our life, to people around us, to our world, to the everyday activities. In another practice instruction, that I call Investigating Wonder, he says, emptying one's sense of self-existence is wondrous. So we all have this. We need to enter adulthood, to grow up, to mature. We need to have some sense of self-existence, some ego. But Hongzhu is then saying, empty one's sense of self-existence. And this is wonderful. Don't be caught by your idea of yourself or your habits of reacting to things based on your habitual patterns of reacting that we've developed, that we need to develop it in some ways to grow out of infancy. So emptying one's sense of self-existence is wondrous, he says. This wonder is embodied with a spirit that can be enacted. So we can actually enact, express. Expression is very important in this teaching. The moon mind with its cloud body is revealed straightforwardly in every direction without resorting to signs or symbols. So Hongzhi particularly uses many nature metaphors in his teaching. This is in part the way that Chan or Zen both brings forth Buddhism but also incorporates the native Chinese Taoist teaching, which was very much appreciation of nature, appreciation of poetry, appreciation of the world around us. So here he says, Hongzhi says, the moon mind in its cloud body forwardly in every direction without resorting to signs or symbols. We don't need to define everything, but we can meet the world of nature. So he says the moon mind, in East Asia, the moon, not just in Buddhism, the full moon is this image of wholeness, completeness, of fullness, of awakening. And cloud body, clouds is an image also for practitioners, for monks in East Asia, but the cloud body, so our practice body. These are metaphors, but they're also exactly just the images of nature. The moon mind with its cloud body is revealed straightforwardly in every direction without resorting to signs or symbols, radiating light everywhere. It responds appropriately to beings and enters the sense dust without confusion. So responding appropriately, it can be a great challenge. Mm-hmm. How do we respond appropriately? How do we, there's a practice in Buddhism called skillful means. How do we respond helpfully? And there's no instruction manual for this. How do we meet the situation right in front of us and respond? And sometimes we don't know what to do. So we could just sit and pay attention. And at some point, maybe we had a sense of how to respond or what might be helpful. And then we learn from trial and error what is helpful and what is not. But this is also a reference to one of the great classical Zen teachers in China, Yunmen, who was asked, what is the teaching of the Buddha's whole lifetime? Any ideas? What is the teaching of the Buddha's whole lifetime? And then that's it. An appropriate response. So how to meet each situation, each person, each event, the dog barking outside, how to experience that, and is there some response that would be helpful? So, Hongzhi says, radiating light everywhere. It responds appropriately to beings and enters the sense dust, the world of sensation, without confusion, without being caught. Overcoming every obstruction, it shines through every empty dharma. Each empty object, each object that is interconnected with everything else. Leaving discriminating conditioning, enter clean, clear wisdom and romp and play in samadhi. What could be wrong? This is how one must genuinely investigate the essence. So, this romping and playing in samadhi actually informs and touches on all the other themes. How we may respond helpfully. How we do the Buddha work. How we turn within and find the source. The swamping and playing and samadhi. Also, the ancestors. So, the ancestors is not just the formal lineage of teachers going back to Shakyamuni, which we have in Zen, but it's also, Hongzhi has a section, all beings are your ancestors. So how do we see all beings as our ancestors and all the events in our life that helped us find this function right now? So again, ancestors can include for us genetic ancestors. How many of you know something about your great-grandparents? Only a few people raised their hand. Okay. But for those of you who didn't raise your hand, how many of you believe that in some way your great-grandparents, whether you know anything about them or not, are part of what you is right now? More people raised their hands. Okay. So we have genetic ancestors, we have cultural ancestors. Are there any musicians here? Yeah, I and a couple of others. Yeah, so there are ancestors, cultural ancestors, people we look back to who inspire us musically, for example, or in terms of other cultural forms, dance or art, or in terms of social, societal response. Many ancestors. How do we appreciate the ancestors? Again, this is not about some stiff, set, one-size-fits-all. It's about play. How do we play with the ancestors? So this is very much part of Zen, where we tell stories that come down to us from, you know, 9th century China or earlier, or from Hongzhe in the 1100s, or Dogen in the 1200s, or Suzuki Roshi way back in the 1960s. So we have all these stories. And, you know, they're sort of pseudo-historical. Some of them are totally based on historical reality, but that's not the point. And actually, a lot of formal academics and scholarship has been about debunking the stories and finding historicity and historical realities. But that's not the point. The point is that we have these stories, we have these sayings that help support and inform us right now, that we can play with. That's very important. It's not about getting some right answer to some koan or teaching story. It's about how do we play with it in terms of our own awareness and our own life. So again, you know, this idea of play, this sitting, even though we sit quietly and upright and we try and sit still, it's not about being stiff or stoic or grim. If you walk into a zendo with a lot of people sitting facing the wall, it might look very grim, but that's not the point. There's actually this play that's going on. This is the training in awareness. And the training in active patience. So patience is very important in our life and in our practice. We sit waiting for the bell to ring so we can get up or do walk or meditation or service or whatever. And this is a training in just sitting, being patient, paying attention. So it's not sleepy. It's or if we're feeling sleepy, like which happens sometimes in long sessions, long Zen retreats for a day or three or seven, some part of the day you might be sleepy, but pay attention to that. Dogen talks about expressing the dream within the dream. So how do we play with the 10,000 things? As one of the ancestors before Hongzhe, actually before the formal Soto lineage, Shito, we chant his harmony of difference and sameness, but we also chant his song of the grass hut, where he talks about the place of sitting, the place of practice. This for him is this grass hut, which is taken literally in numbers of times and in history, but also is a metaphor for Zendo, for this space in which we engage in practice. Hongzhi said, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Now, when you first start sitting and trying to sit upright and getting your legs into some funny position or whatever, it may not feel like relaxing. But doing sustained practice, we kind of release, let go into uprightness, into stillness, into being present and facing the wall, facing ourselves, facing the world. And we let go of all of the conditioned karma in our life. It doesn't go away, you don't ignore it, but Shuto says, let go of hundreds of years, relax completely. So, you know, the ideal, one ideal, is that we sit upright, silent, still, facing the wall, facing ourselves, and just relax into being present and allow whatever is arising to arise, thoughts and feelings, don't try and figure anything out with them, just let them go and then they come again. But be aware. So let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. The spirit of playfulness is also about creativity. So Zazen is a practice of creativity. We're performing the Buddha on our own seat. So we have in the middle of the Zendo, in the front of the Zendo, this image of Shakyamuni Buddha or some Buddha sitting upright, awakened. And we each, in our own way, sit like Buddha. What is, nobody can tell you how to be here. Each of us has their own way of expressing awareness, total awareness, and sustained awareness, and ongoing awareness. So it's not like we have some awakening and then we're finished. The Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, when he became the Buddha 2,500 years ago, more or less in Northeast India, he didn't stop practicing, he didn't stop awakening, he continued every day. But this has to do with the spirit of playfulness and creativity. And Zazen is a creative practice, and it supports our other creative practices. So if you're a musician, or an artist, or a writer, or if you're a cook, or a gardener, or if you're in a relationship, and expressing the creativity of a relationship, or parenting, all of those are creative practices, and Zazen supports them. How do we express Buddha on our seat and in everyday activities when we get up from sitting? So romping and playing in samadhi is not just what we do in the Zendo. It's this background samadhi or awareness or concentration that informs the rest of our everyday activity through our life. And again, this playfulness is important in all of these practices, in responding to the world and doing the Buddha work, in returning to the source, finding the source of this experience right now. How is this arising for all of us? And also in meeting the ancestors, and appreciating the ancestors and being informed by the ancestors. The spirit of play is very important. It's not how Zazen and Zen practice is sometimes portrayed, but this is what Hongzhi is talking about, and later Dogen, and our Soto way of practice. So we have time for some questions, comments, discussion. So people online, David, you can help me. And I'll try and see the people in the room. And say your name first. And so please, comments, questions, anything, feel free. Is somebody over there? Is a question? Yes. So sometimes when we sit and wait for somebody to say something at the end of the talk, you know, I like to have active discussion, but we have limited time.
There's so many.
Okay, I can't see. So yes, hi, in the back in the corner. Say your name, please.
I'm Chelsea, hi.
Hi, Chelsea.
So you said earlier in your talk that you've asked us what do we think the primary goal of the Buddha's life is, like, and you said it was to, like, you know, appropriately approach situations and things like that. But obviously, so, I mean, I'm not necessarily familiar with Zen Buddhism. We haven't gone there in class yet. full disclosure. But I know sure. Many of the other teachings say that, like, the Buddha's life is devoted to, like, oneness and, like, promoting Buddhism and being a spiritual leader. It seems like a primary crisis of faith in, like, the tantric traditions, the fact that, like, the Buddha had to be alive and then when he wasn't here, maybe he could learn from. So how do you reconcile believing his like one purpose to be approaching situations appropriately if it seems like so many other schools of thought point to like much more profound reasons for his being?
Oh, an appropriate response is so profound. But actually all of them are the same. All of them are one thing. So keeping alive the tradition is one. Helping, doing the Buddha work, helping others to awaken, continuing to awaken oneself, ongoing awakening. Dogen talked about Buddha beyond Buddha. So those are not separate things. The way we usually think is that we divide things up into separate objects. That's our usual, you know, because we're conditioned. Well, are any of you not native English speakers? Okay, few. Okay, well, in English anyway, we have subject, verb, object. That's how we think. So we think of objects out there, and we try and verb them, manipulate them to get what we want. Or we think of ourselves as objects potentially being verbed by subjects out there, and we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Or sometimes we may be. But anyway, the point is that we think that our usual way of thinking, discrimination, is to divide things up into little boxes. What Zen is talking about is not ignoring that we do that. That's our conditioned consciousness, and we can't ignore that. That's one reality. But also, there's just this romping and playing in samadhi. There's just this taking care of all beings. There's just taking care of a tradition of awakening. And maybe there are many traditions of awakening that are part of this Buddha practice, but, you know, in today's pluralist world, we respect all forms of Buddhism, and we learn from them. It's not just that we tolerate them. And all different spiritual paths. So all of those are part of this one thing, which Hongzhi sometimes calls romping and playing in samadhi, or young men called an appropriate response. How do we respond appropriately to the difficulties of the world, to the difficulties of the people around us, friends and family? How do we respond appropriately to the difficulties in our own heart and minds? So all of this is one thing. So yeah, Chelsea.
So is what you're saying that, like, rather than eliminating our like suffering or dukkha by means of just like relinquishing all desires, you're saying that like this other way would be to sort of approach everything with like the same level of like expectations almost, or the same level of like everything is profound and hence nothing is like making you suffer if you treat everything as an equal. Does that sound?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Because there is suffering in the world. And we respond to suffering. So it's not that everything is just wonderful. I mean, everything is just wonderful. And people are starving and being persecuted around the world. And, you know, we have difficulties with friends and family members and so forth and so on. It's just endless. But what's an appropriate response? How do we play with the interactions involved? how do we not hold on to some formula for what to do? How are we open to some new way of seeing things, or to listening to somebody else who has a different perspective than us? So it's all part of this appropriate response is romping and playing in samadhi, and it's relieving, it's awakening and relieving suffering of all beings, and it's all together. But thank you for your good question. Other comments, responses, questions online? Also.
Dennis's hand was up before. Dennis, I don't know if you have a question now.
Hi, Dennis.
Thank you very much, Tigran. You've kind of touched on this, but it's the question of appropriate response. I'm raised in a culture and a religious tradition that had questions and there were right answers. So you get into that whole question of right versus wrong. And the word appropriate implies that there is one response, or can imply. That's and could you comment on the word appropriate relative to response?
Right. Yeah. No. Thank you, Dennis. No. Sometimes we think there's one right response, but an appropriate response is a response that is acknowledging and seeing the differences of different people and different beings in different situations and responding to that situation. So Buddhist ethics is situational. It's not about one right, it's not about 10 ultimate commandments that tell you what to do. It's about seeing, being awake to, playing in samadhi with whatever's in front of us and whatever is around us and whatever the situation is. So an appropriate response is not one right appropriate response to all situations, or to all people, or to all beings. So this requires some patience. This is not easy. If we have one, authoritarianism relies on there's one right answer and one right, there's one ruler and they tell you what to do. But actually, being awake is to see that we each have our own function, we each have our own dharma position, and every situation has its own particular context. So how do we respond to that particular situation? So this play also means like the play of like a tool that moves, so how do we see differences and respond to them? And, there may be good responses to particular questions, but the things change. Probably you've all noticed that the world changes and you change and people around you change. And we've all been through a pandemic where it changed a lot of things. So how do we respond? We're still in recovery from that. How do we respond to a particular situation? And that requires some investigation. And it's not that we should not use discursive linear thinking as a tool to help, but it's beyond that. It's organic. There's a play there. So the right answer for one person might not be the right answer for other people. A good example is 12-step programs, and we have a meditation recovery group here online Tuesday evenings. I know some people for whom one sip of alcohol would be devastating and calamitous. People who are alcoholics, even if they haven't had a drink in decades. People like that. And for some people, having a glass of wine a couple times a week or something is not calamitous. It's okay. It's kind of socially informative or helpful, maybe. So it's not one size, one rule fits all. We have to see the situation and see the particular person. So thank you for your question. Other questions, comments? Yes, hi. Say your name, please.
I'm Ona.
Ona?
Yes. So I was wondering, we were talking about...
Can you hear her online?
Can you hear online? Yes.
Okay.
Thumbs up, yes.
Speak up, please.
So we were talking about finding a source and what is the source. And my question is, when I meditate about a question, when I'm trying to find something, I find that I tend to get too attached to the future, like when will I find the answer to this question?
Yeah.
So how do I focus on the question, but at the same time try to keep myself in the present without becoming attached to the future?
Well, the present includes the future, it includes the past. Everybody you've ever known is part of us on your seat right now, in some way. So it's not about, being here now is not about avoiding or trying to get rid of the future or the past. They're all included. But you were asking about the source. It's something that is arising in each moment. So, how do we see our thoughts as they arise? And it's not that we have to track or decipher or designate, you know, how we're thinking, but just to be present in your body and aware. And if you're going to the future, okay, that's, you know, that's what's happening right now, actually. I think Chelsea, is that your name, Ben? Yeah, I was talking about expectations. And nothing ever, ever happens exactly according to our expectation. Oh, maybe it happens, you know, once in a century, I don't know, or a few times in a lifetime. But did any of you expect this particular talk? Or, you know, things happen, but we can't control the future. We envision the future. We can have positive visions of the future, which is really helpful, you know, because a lot of the times now in our culture we see the future as, you know, apocalyptic and all that, and that's not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. The future is not set. So having positive sense of the future is very helpful, can be very helpful, but it's all what's happening right now. So trying to restrict your awareness right now to some very limited place where you're not thinking about anything, and there's no future, there's no past, that's not reality. So the source is arising all the time. And you can kind of see how your thought, you know, see where your thought arises and look back at that maybe. But the point is just to be present and aware and pay attention to all of it. It's not forbidden to have thoughts of the future or thoughts of the past or even thoughts of the present. The appropriate response includes all of it. So other comments or questions? Yes, in the back there. And say your name, please.
Yes, I'm Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
I have a question about appropriateness, like outside of like, this space and meditation, how should we approach or like guide ourselves to find like appropriateness in like the day-to-day life?
Good. Yes, this is an important ancient question in our tradition. Yes. How do we bring this awareness into our everyday activity? And there's not one right clear answer. But as we sit in Zazen formally or on your own at home or whatever, we get a glimpse of something deeper. And we don't have to hold on to it. You know, so we don't try and grasp on to somewhere, even if we have some great understanding or dramatic experience of ultimate reality. For trying to grasp onto it and hold on to it and get back to it doesn't help. That's not the point. But it's in the background. And the more you, so I recommend doing this for people who want to do this practice, to do it regularly, to do it, to continue doing it every day or several times a week, just to stop and sit. It doesn't have to be 30 minutes or 40 minutes, it could be 20 minutes, but just sit and be present and see what's arising and face the wall and face yourself. And then, with that experience, as you sustain that experience, it becomes a kind of sense faculty or kind of a background awareness in our everyday activity. And it does show up, even though we're not thinking about it, that people regularly report this. Suzuki Roshi, who founded our tradition in San Francisco in the 60s, he said, we're always losing our balance against a background of perfect balance. So to have some sense of this background, of wholeness, of the ultimate source of this interconnectedness with everything in the background. And then, you know, we bumble around and trying to take care of our everyday activities. But it helps to, you know, when we're feeling frustrated and we're feeling confused or upset, to stop and take a breath, and maybe we can feel some of this background perfect balance, and then we continue trying to respond appropriately. So thank you so much for your question. This is a great challenge. This is the question of our practice. Yes, Eve, hi.
Yeah, I just have a comment on that, because I mean, I come here, I think a lot of us come here for guidance, and you know, we get guidance as Taigen just said, in our own practice and the instructions for the practice and following the instructions, but you know, listening to the talks, that gives guidance too. And you know, like for me, I get angry. One of the people I work with is always putting stuff in boxes and acting like the boxes are, you know, like real and rigid, and I get like really mad. And because I don't see the boundaries that way. But, you know, listening to Taigen talk about it helps me realize that, you know, maybe the getting mad part isn't the most appropriate response. And so I just have to, you know, like let go of it. And, okay, that's how she thinks. And that's her, you know, response. But that doesn't stop me from responding the way, you know, I think is appropriate. So.
But what's appropriate is for your function, your dharma position, to respond to where they are at, not to impose your idea of reality on somebody else. It doesn't work so well.
No.
So how do
and then I get mad because she's trying to impose her view of reality on me.
Of course, yeah. So how do we respond to that? This is challenging. This isn't easy.
No.
So thank you for that. So, yes, almost time to stop, but if there's another comment or question, either online or in the class. Micah, did you have something? Oh, no, hi.
Hi, Shinkan. I would like your thoughts on the dream within the dream, Dogen's dream within the dream. I think that I might have had a notion in my early practice that the dream within a dream was a delusion. But within the context of this talk in Samadhi, it sounds like the dream within the dream could be reality just so.
It's all reality just so. It's all reality. The great visionary poet, William Blake, British poet, said anything that can be imagined is an image of the truth. So I'm going to do a half-day seminar later in the fall about Rinpoche Setsu Dogen's teaching about expressing the dream in the dream. So we, in conventional thought in Buddhism, is that we shouldn't dream. We should wake up from all the dreams and all the delusions, mm-hmm. and that there's something called awakening that where there's nothing like that. No delusions, no dreaming. Dogen says to be in the dream throughout the dream, to be in awakening throughout awakening. And he says that delusion is to be deluded about awakening. Awakening is to be awakened about delusions. So you should appreciate your dreams, not try and get rid of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't remember my dreams so often, but anyway, it's that in this essay in Shobo Genzo, which is says in expressing the dream within the dream, Dogen emphasizes in many ways expression. How do we express ourselves? And so inside this dream of sitting in this Lincoln Square Zendo with all these people, how do you express that dream in your awareness? That's the point. And then what is the appropriate expression? You know, that's talking about appropriate response. But to actually we should get to know our delusions. This is one of the most important parts of sustained Zazen practice, is we get to see our ideas and delusions and attachments and grasping and aversion and anger. We see all that arising in ourselves, and it's not about getting rid of it. It's about becoming intimate with it, familiar with it, so that we don't react based on those delusions, but that we can respond, knowing how we do react. So we all have patterns of grasping and desire and aversion and anger, even hatred sometimes. Maybe he hates your coworker sometimes. But how do we avoid being caught by those reactions? I didn't mean to pick on
that. No, I know.
How do we avoid being caught by our own stuff? So the dreams, whether they're waking dreams, in medieval Japanese Buddhism, they talk a lot about dreams. Keizan, the second founder of Soto Zen, used his dreams to decide where to set up temples, or Buddha did priest ordination, for example. So we can use our dreams, but not to be caught by them. And how do we express the dream? So anyway, I'll talk about that in more detail next fall. But thank you for the question. And there's another question then, Mike?
I just had a quick follow-up to that. To me, that makes me think that dreams are reality because our brains create them.
Sure.
They make them up, and just like they create our thoughts and our delusions and our view of what's going on right now, like my brain has created this experience of me seeing everyone here, and that's my thing. But that is my reality, and so it's not separate. And so to sit with all of that as part of how I purport my own dharma can be helpful, can be struggling, can be hard, can be wonderful. I don't know,
Yeah. So there's a kind of gradation of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And we might think that we have to reach the highest state of awareness. And some people think that that's what Buddhism is about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are experiences of whatever you want to call them, exaltation or whatever, but that's not the point. The point is, how do we bring our awareness and our appropriate response into everything? How do we romp and play in samadhi in all situations? So thank you for that. So I think we're past time. We'll have our closing bodhisattva vows, which we chant three times, and those are on page
36.
36.
We chant three times, and
then we'll have announcements.
Beings are numberless. We have freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is up. unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it.